good evening to you once again. It's now time for the Better Health Radio Show. And on deck this evening to present to you is Dr. Kia Lewis. And of course, she'll have her guests with her to bring you another stellar presentation of the Better Health Radio Show. So without further ado, let's go across and say a pleasant evening to the good doctor. Good evening, Dr. Lewis.
Hi, good evening, Gregson. How are you?
Yes, please. I'm not too bad this evening at all. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well. I trust you had a good week.
It wasn't too bad, I must say. It wasn't too bad at all. Would have been better if Argentina got beaten yesterday, but nevertheless, that's my
point. I know some men going to need some health checks, some blood pressure checks in this World Cup that's going on.
Yes,
but
yes.
We're always happy to assist.
Correct.
I want to say a warm good evening to our listeners. Welcome again to another edition of the Better Health Radio Show, a show which is aimed at raising public awareness of common health issues that affect us all. Like Gregson has said, I'm Dr. Lewis. It's an absolute pleasure to be your host this evening. We have another topical and captivating program for you this evening. So if you've just joined us, keep your radios locked to the station. And we're very much looking forward to an engaging and interactive session. So I'm going to take this opportunity, as I always do at the top of the hour, to remind you that you can call in and contact us with your questions and your comments at 434-1790, 434-1790. We certainly love to hear from you. If you're a bit radio shy and you prefer to send a WhatsApp, please feel free to send those messages to 266-4862. That's 266-4862. Now, this evening, I don't really know what to title the show, but we're going to be talking a bit about what we would call those flu-like illnesses. You know, in Barbados, everything is either the cold or the flu. But with the advent of COVID, we've learned that there are many other things that can cause those similar symptoms. And the reason why we want to talk about it this evening is because we realize as we get down to the end of the year and those colder months, we can get a lot of these flu-like illnesses, you know, with the runny nose and the cough. Now, in the last 2 years, if anybody coughed or sneezed in our presence, you know, everybody looked around sharply and assumed this person must have had COVID. And we've had so much conversation about COVID. We have a lot of COVID experts out there in the community. But there's so many other viruses and bacterial illnesses that can cause common symptoms. So we're going to take the opportunity this evening to have our expert guests discuss with you some of the other viruses that are going around. Some of you might have visited your doctor's offices with these symptoms, the cough, the runny nose, the sore throat, and been told you need a COVID test, and that test came back negative. So we know many other things that are going around out there. And I'm going to take this opportunity to introduce our guest, Dr. Marquita Gittin-St-Hilaire. Like I said, she's an expert in this field. She is a lecturer in microbiology at the University of the West Indies, CAFO, the former director of the now defunct Leptospira Laboratory. She specializes in molecular diagnostics of infectious diseases, particularly arboviruses, leptospirosis, and has an avid interest in the investigation and epidemiology of multi-drug resistant pathogens. So that's a lot of big words. But just to let you know a little bit more about her, she is a member of the CARVET Net Technical Working Group, the American Society of Microbiology. She's a country representative for the Caribbean Association of Clinical Microbiologists and the chair of the CARVET Net Technical Working Group. She's also a member of the Quadripartite Technical Working Group on Antimicrobial Resistance. So we want to wish, after all of this grand introduction, all of that to say, we definitely have an expert in the field with qualifications that I cannot even pronounce. Dr. Marquita Gittin-St-Hilaire, welcome to the show this evening.
Hi, good evening, everyone. And thank you, Dr. Lewis, for the invitation. And yes, we're here to talk about all those things that, you know, all those little colds, those little sniffles and so forth. So I'll try my best to answer the questions as they arise. And, you know, to help you to understand the whole process of respiratory tract infections.
Awesome. So When we talk about the respiratory tract, we're really talking about the breathing system. It can affect the nose, the back of the throat, all the way down to the lungs. And like we said, there are a number of viruses. Some of you might have heard of RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus. This is a virus that Dr. Cave would have spoken about with a concern that there might be more children contracting it this year. And so we thought it would be good if we talked a little bit about RSV. So first of all, Dr. Gittinsmeyer, the first question I want to ask you is, what really is RSV?
So RSV, as you called the name before, is known as respiratory syncytial virus. And it's a very common virus associated with infections of the lung and the respiratory tract. And we've been seeing increasing numbers of this infection in the US and Canada, particularly in children. And they would have seen it somehow, you know, coming out of some of the lockdowns and so forth that we would have seen. And this infection is one of the more common causes of respiratory tract infections. And we can go in a lot into the virology, you know, what type of virus and so that it is, but just to say that it is also not one of the nicest infections to have, because it can cause a wide range of symptoms.
Yes, and we're going to talk about those symptoms for sure. We know a lot of, for example, about how COVID is transmitted, so how it goes from person to person, or how you can get it, rather, I should say. Can you tell us a little bit about how RSV, how do you contract RSV?
So like a lot of the other causes of respiratory tract infections, and even if we had to go back and think about COVID, we know about coughing. You know, when you cough, you release these droplets that get into the air. Sneezing, same thing. Some talking and so forth. So all of these actions basically release what we call droplets, respiratory droplets that contain the virus into the atmosphere. And then the person can come along and they can breathe it or so forth. Sometimes these viruses can actually touch surfaces. So they can touch like the table, they can touch doorknobs, it can touch your clothing and so forth, and you can come along because the organism, the virus, can remain on these surfaces for a few hours, and so you can come and touch these surfaces, and then you can, you know, put your hand in your eyes, or you can put it in your mouth and so forth, and you can actually acquire the infection from there. So very similar to how COVID-19 was transmitted through these respiratory droplets. So when you talk, you know, we talk about golf balls and all types of things like that. Well, mm-hmm. We have the organism or the virus is basically in that droplet. And when you it comes out through sneezing or coughing and so forth. And when you inhale it, or when you touch surfaces and put it in your eyes or in your mouth, you can get the infection from there. So basically, that's how it is transmitted.
Right. So you know what that means? And I want to point this out. It means that you don't necessarily have to be around somebody who is sick. So because sometimes we get these sniffles and these coughs and we think, but I don't remember being around somebody who was sick. But it could be that you just pass and touch a surface where somebody who was sick would have left their droplets. And then you touch the face or some other part.
Yeah. So that's what can happen. You know, and a lot of that happens a lot because you're thinking, well, where did I get this thing from? Mm-hmm. But, you know, even if the person had some secretions, some nasal secretions, you had a runny nose or so forth, and you know, you took your hand and you wiped your nose and then you put it somewhere, you know, then somebody can come along and touch it, and then they can put it into their own, on their face, their mouth, eyes, and so forth. Because the eyes, people don't think about this, but your eye is a good conduit for a lot of these infections.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. You can definitely contaminate yourself through your eyes. People don't think about that. Yes, and that's why hand hygiene is really important, making sure that you're keeping your hands clean. But we're going to come to that when we talk about prevention. Yeah. So one of the things I want to know, sometimes people sit in the office with me and they say, Doc, you know, I spoke to my work colleague, or I spoke to my mother or whoever yesterday, and then the very next day I started to feel ill. So it must be that person. But we know that with different viruses, The time between when you contact the virus and you actually develop symptoms is different. So what is, that's what we call the incubation period, right? So what is the incubation period like for RSV?
So that's around between 3 to 5 days. As Dr. Lewis was mentioned, some other viruses might have a shorter time, some might have a longer time. But for respiratory syncytial virus, it usually takes between 3 to 5 days after being in contact with that person who also had the infection, respiratory syncytial virus, for you to actually develop any signs and symptoms following that interaction.
Right, so 3 to 5 days. And what are some of these symptoms that we are looking at with this? Because the symptoms are similar, but there's some little differences between the different infections. What are some of these symptoms?
So for RSV in particular, it can start off as though you are having the common cold. So you have things like a runny nose, you know, you think you're coming out with the cold, you have a runny nose, you might not feel like eating, so you have a decreased appetite. Some persons might end up with coughing and sneezing. Some persons might also end up with fever. And one of the particular things that is quite common with this is, and in particular age groups, is wheezing. So some persons can present with wheezing, and you might think it might be some sort of asthma or exacerbation of asthma and so forth, but it can actually be that the person is presenting with this this particular infection. But as I said before, it, you know, basically starts out as though you're having the common cold, the normal symptoms, the runny nose and so forth, don't feel like eating, coughing, sneezing, general signs, but then you can have fever in some persons, and then you can also have this wheeze as well.
Yeah, and wheeze is very characteristic because, like you said, you don't have to have asthma to develop a wheeze with RSV. That's a very important point.
Yes, you don't have to.
And then once you get over the infection, it doesn't mean that you are asthmatic, because some people automatically assume once they have wheeze, most of the time once you wheeze, you're asthmatic, but RSV is different. So you can wheeze with RSV, but not have a diagnosis of asthma afterwards.
Yes.
So we talked about the wheeze. I wonder what are some of the complications then, or rather before we get to the complications, I think an important point would be who are the persons, the age groups that are most likely to be affected, because I think that leads into discussion about the complications.
So this is actually quite important. And for a lot of respiratory tract infections, we will find that they affect those who are very young. So very young, and those who are elderly. This particular infection though, it tends to peak around those between the ages of 2 and 8 months. So you will tend to get the majority of infections occurring in the young within that age group, between 2 months and 8 months, and then those who are elderly, so those over 65 and over. We can also see this infection in persons who might have some sort of chronic heart or lung disease, and persons who might have, you know, very weak immune systems, either by disease or by some form of medication or so forth. But if you have a weak immune system, you are prone to developing this infection or acquiring this infection and it becoming severe. Or you, if you have a chronic lung disease or a chronic heart disease, remember, RSV already affects the lungs. And if you already have a chronic lung condition and you get RSV, of course, it's going to make the whole situation a lot worse. But you tend to get the infection predominantly in those between the age of 2 to 8 months and those older than 65 years. It doesn't mean that those in between will not get RSV. What it does mean, though, is that as you get older, so beyond the 8 months or beyond the 2 years in general, you tend to have a lot milder symptoms and so forth. It tends to be more of a you know, more like a common cold, an upper respiratory tract infection. It might affect the nostrils, the nares, and so forth, but it wouldn't get into the lungs. For these persons, those two age groups, It can actually get into the lungs, and then it can cause major problems in those persons. They've also found that persons with diabetes as well are those that are most affected too. So we can add persons with diabetes and so forth to that list.
And that's really important, because we have a significant burden of diabetes in Barbados, not only among the elderly population, but we have a significant burden among our young people as well. And so that is an additional risk factor, very much like it was for COVID, that caused some issues.
Yes.
So yes. We would have talked then, we said that anybody can get it basically, but those who will get the more severe type of infection are likely to be in these age groups and with these risk factors. So what does that severe infection look like? What are some of the complications that you can expect to see with respiratory syncytial virus?
So outside of death, and we'll put that one aside, because persons can die from this infection, but there are other manifestations that can occur. So persons can get pneumonia, and those will be the elderly. They can go on to get pneumonia following this infection. So you can really get, you know, it can get into the lower areas of the respiratory tract and into the lungs. And those who are younger, there's also a very severe complication that they can get. They can get what is known as bronchiolitis. So that sounds like a big word, but what it means is that they can get infections of these small airways within the lungs. So that can be infected, and then it can be very severe. So, you know, they can get nasal flaring, they can have rapid breathing, they can have a rapid heart rate. It looks as though they have lost their breath and so forth. So we can get, and they can get a lot of, so then you can get a lot of other manifestations. You know, they might have poor feeding and so forth in those young individuals that would have required that infection. So that's one of the complications. So one of the complications in those who are very young with bronchiolitis, where it affects the small airway tubes within the lungs. And then for those who are older, then it would basically affect the lung in general. And that can actually lead to the demise of those persons. We should note that one of the common causes of death in the elderly is pneumonia.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely correct. And so these persons, these high-risk persons, are the ones who are more likely to end up needing cure at the hospital because of the severity of their symptoms. And one of the things that I want to point out to mothers, like we said, young babies can become very ill with RSV. And so anytime you have a child who is very irritable, who is not feeding well, and they have those classic symptoms of fever and so forth, it's really important that you seek medical attention for that baby. Langston, I see you lining up. Do we have a caller?
No, I was just adjusting my mic so that when we do have a call, well, there's none here. But there's one query, isn't really related to your topic, but it's really at the good doctor here, Dr. Giddens, St. Hilaire's. WhatsApper wants to know, if you care to answer, if you're a past student of the Louis Lynch Secondary School.
Yes, I am.
Well, they probably recognize you then, your name or something. All right.
You're repping, man. Yeah.
They asked me that bright
yes,
and early.
I am.
All right. So that's your answer, WhatsApper. Go ahead, please.
All right, fantastic. So that's just something that we would have wanted to point out, the importance of seeking early medical attention if the baby is sick and not feeding well and so forth, just to make sure that, you know, the child is okay and it's something that you can manage at home. So we talked about the complications now. My question then would be, with all these possible severe complications, what is the treatment for this particular virus?
We would all want every virus to have a specific treatment. But unfortunately, for this one, there is no specific treatment for this infection. There's no agent that's going to attack this virus and get rid of it. So basically, at the end of the day, what the treatment or what the physician will do, even if it's a severe infection, is basically to treat the symptoms. Mm-hmm. So you're basically, using support therapy. You're basically just managing the symptoms as they arise. So if the person has a fever, you give them something for the fever. You make sure they're well hydrated and so forth. You make sure that, all these symptoms are any fevers, if they have, as I said, proper hydration needs to be maintained. If it needs to be any mucus or anything removed, you can take medication for that. So it is basically supportive therapy. There's no cure for it at all, and neither are there any vaccines for it.
Right, so no cure, no vaccine. And can I get it more than once? Have I had it as a child and then beat it? Can I get it again?
These viruses are many in number. So we may think, well, I have had RSV before. I possibly can get RSV again. These viruses have many different, like COVID, how you had Alpha and Beta and Delta and Omicron and all those things. And then all the ones in between, RSV is similar. So you can actually get it more than once, not the same one, as in the same type or the same strain. But because there are so many different strains, you can get different strains of RSV. So essentially, you can get it more than once. Because there's no, as I said, there's so many different strains of it. You can certainly get it more than once. You might be protected against that particular strain that you had initially, but subsequent strains and so forth, you can get those.
Thankfully, as we get older, we grow up with childhood. It's like you said, it's a lot more mild.
Yes.
So that's a great thing. I want to remind our viewers, or rather, our listeners, that you can call in with your questions or comments at 434-1790. You can also WhatsApp us at 266-4862. If you've just joined us this evening, we are talking about respiratory viruses, big words to say, those little issues that cause the little runny nose and the sore throat, because there are many other things out there other than COVID. And so we thought that we would educate you on those particular organisms and those illnesses and what you should look for, warning signs, etc. So we want you to stay with us. And if you want to call in and share your experience, many of our listeners would have had COVID, and then you might have had another viral infection after. You might notice that there are significant differences between what you experienced with COVID and what you experienced with another infection. Please feel free to call in and let us know what your experience is. Have been. So we've talked a lot about RSV. I think that we should be almost experts by now. So what I want to move on to is the flu. We call everything the flu or the cold, but the flu is a very specific thing. In fact, we heard that COVID was a flu, and that was a pet peeve of mine, because COVID and the flu are two very different things. I'm going to pause here. We're going to go into a discussion about the flu, but we have a caller. So I'm going to pause to allow for that even now. Caller, good evening.
Good evening, Doc.
Yes, welcome to the show.
I want to ask a different question. Right, as a diabetic, right? But sometimes my foot is free, like if it wet. What could cause that there? I sometimes have worn socks at night so that my foot could feel comfortable. But, as I say, it's free like if it wet, and I don't know what it's free up there sometimes. What could cause that?
When you touch it with your hand, it's actually wet.
No.
Or it just has that sensation.
Yeah.
Like it feels cold?
It feels like, if it's sweating or something. But
okay.
If we take off the socks, it don't feel wet now and then, so you don't know what it's called, that sensation.
Well, I'm going to give you a short answer, because like you said, we're not necessarily talking about this topic, but we know that with diabetes, the nerves can be affected, and so you can have different sensations in the feet, sensations that may feel strange. I wouldn't know your particular case, but certainly anytime that you're concerned about a new feature, a new feeling in the feet as a diabetic, you should always seek medical attention and bring it up with your doctor so that they can inspect the feet and make sure that you don't have anything serious going on. So my advice would be to you to make sure that you bring this up with your personal doctor and have it checked out. Well, I hope that helps.
My foot suffers with neuropathy, so I don't know if that's right, but I do a lot of walking on the foot because I used to walk with a cane, but I don't walk with a cane anymore. I just walk on my own, so I don't know if it's because, but I was saying so, but I don't know, you know, but I do a lot of walking. No. You know, I do a lot of walking. But, you know, I will always check it out.
That's always the best thing to do.
Because of the nerves, too. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely check in with your doctor and just have them take another look at it.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, have a good evening.
All right, thank you, caller. Doc, before you run away, we've got another one for you. Let's see if we can get them up here at the same time. Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, yes, sir. How are you doing, sir?
Well, not as good as you, but we're all in the best of good health.
Well, thank you. Yes, what is your query for the good doctors here, please?
Yes, yeah, special good evening to all the doctors.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
What I wanted to you to explain, because I'm always trying to find out, especially at this time, with all these types of viruses going wrong, could you explain for the public the difference between a core infection and a reinfection, and at this stage, how you, with your expert knowledge, as I'm hearing, you'll be able to advise yourself to keep away?
Right. Can you repeat that again? You said the difference between a core infection and a reinfection?
Yes, please.
Is that correct?
And that knowledge, could you share that knowledge you have with us so that we can keep away? It doesn't mean that we wouldn't come to get your business going, but we will want to keep away from those infections. We wouldn't stop you from surviving. We just want to keep away.
We want to keep you away. That's why we do this show. It doesn't hurt our business if you're healthy. Trust me. Dr. Gittin said hello. I will forward that question over to you.
Okay, so he was looking at, he asked about core infections and reinfection. So core, when you have a core infection, you have two organisms or two viruses, say for example, causing infection at the same time. So you can have, and I'm just going to, you know, just mention two, not to say that these are two you can get at the same time, even though in science there's always the great possibility of. So say, for instance, if you're talking about a core infection, you might have an infection with, say, for instance, coronavirus, and then you can have, at the same time, you can have an infection with the same RSV that we were talking about just now, and they can both manifest symptoms at the same time. So usually, when you have a core infection, you know, it tends to progress a lot more quickly and so forth. For a reinfection, it means that you would have had one virus infection from before, and you can get the same virus infection again. Usually that's not quite as common with viruses. You tend to see reinfections more with like bacterial infections, particularly if the bacterial infection was not treated well. Or, you know, and being on the antimicrobial resistant stream, if you don't take all the antibiotics that the doctor has prescribed for you, when the doctor has said take all of these antibiotics, it means then that you can become reinfected. You can have the same organism causing an infection again because it was not properly treated before. So you can either have a relapse, or you can have a reinfection with the same organism, particularly if it was improperly treated.
All right. That's a very thorough answer. Koya, does that answer your question?
Yes, please. But also, I would like you to tell the patients they need to stick close to the doctors at this time. Because COVID ain't gone nowhere. It's still here. And if you're frightened to let the government know that, I land a mitt for you now.
Yes, COVID is very much still out there. So we want people to continue to, you know, to protect themselves, use their hand sanitizer, you know, wear their mask where appropriate, social distancing, the things that they need to do. And like you said, if you are a patient, especially if you have high blood pressure, diabetes, or some other illness or comorbidity, it's important to stick close to the doctors so that your conditions are well controlled. The blood pressure is under control. The blood sugar isn't too high. And that gives you a better chance of being able to fight off these infections. So thank you so much for your contribution, caller. Yes,
thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hope. You have a good evening. I've got another query here for the good doctor. I've got two. Let's see which one we'll go with first. This one says, good evening. Is there a reason why in Barbados we do not push annual flu shots like in the US of A? Is the lack of winter weather a factor, good doctor? That's query number one.
All right, so I'll pass that on to you. About to get in.
Okay, so in terms of the vaccine, the influenza vaccine that's offered, the WHO actually recommends that there's a subset of persons who should get this this vaccine. And I'll just mention those and I'll then come back and answer the question as best as I can. So WHO has a recommendation, and it's particularly for those who are pregnant at any stage during pregnancy, children aged between 6 months and 5 years, those who are older than 65, persons with any chronic medical conditions, and healthcare workers. So those are the primary persons that WHO recommend should have the annual vaccination. It doesn't mean that other persons should not get vaccinated, but those are the primary ones. Now, the thing with influenza in the temperate countries, so those colder climates, they tend to have influenza, you know, in the autumn and winter, in the winter months, particularly in the winter months, they have real large outbreaks of influenza. We in Barbados also end up having similar outbreaks because of tourism and so forth, so persons actually bring it here. It doesn't mean that it is not pushed as much, but because of the sheer numbers of persons who can actually get this infection in those temperate countries, they tend to be much larger than countries such as Barbados, which is more tropical. That's why it probably would be pushed a lot more. Of course, there's some other reasons why, but that would be the predominant reason why they would want to push it more in temperate countries. Because within temperate countries, you must recognize that during winter, everyone is kind of in close confines. You know, everybody's inside the house or whatever. So if you have an infection with the flu, it can certainly be transmitted to all of those in the household. And this can be, you know, this can be in a continuum. So this can happen all the time throughout winter. If it does happen in Barbados, we're not confined to inside because we are in a more tropical either we can go out and we can, you know, we're not necessarily confined to inside. So the probability of transmission is much lower than that in the temperate countries, but it doesn't mean that it is really pushed any less, because yes, there are at least five specific groups, but it doesn't mean that other persons shouldn't really be vaccinated.
All right. Thank you, Doc. Before we go on to the other query here, I've got a caller on the line, so let's see if we can bring him in, please. Good evening.
Hello, good evening.
Yes, they can hear you. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, good evening to you, Gregston. Happy good evening to doctors. Happy independence to the doctors as well.
Thank you.
Doctors.
Thank you. Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you very much. Doctors, explain to me what is the difference between chronic bronchitis and asthma. I know a person who was once told that they was an asthmatic, and later on in life, they was told that they had chronic bronchitis. Explain the difference to me.
Dr. Gittings?
Pardon me?
Okay.
Yeah, stand by. She's going to answer you now. Hold on, please.
So, chronic bronchitis, you can have, acute bronchitis is usually persons who have a continuous production of phlegm for, you know, like a 2 to 3 week period. For persons with chronic bronchitis, they have a production of phlegm for several months in 1 year, but this is because of a viral infection. Most often, it's associated with a virus, so the person would have a viral infection. With asthma, on the other hand, it is not like that. It's not a viral infection at all. It's not a virus that results in wheezing or any of the other classical things that you will see associated with asthma. It has nothing to do with that. But bronchitis is more of is more associated with viral infections. Asthma isn't.
One more last question. What they mean when they say the tightness? Explain to me about the tightness in an asthmatic. What is this tightness and how is it?
The tightness in the chest.
Yes, the tightness. Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Gittins, you want me to answer or you want to answer?
You go ahead and answer that one.
So most of the time when asthmatics talk about tightness in the chest, it's because the airways can get very small and you can have a lot of inflammation in the airways, which makes it difficult to breathe. And so that gives the sensation as though the chest is very tight. And that's where we give medication, which helps to open up the airways, what we call bronchodilators, and it helps to relieve that symptom of chest tightness.
And does the inhaler help that?
Yes, the inhalers, depends on the type of inhaler, but typically the blue inhaler, what we call Ventolin, that's what we call a bronchodilator. That simply means it opens up the airways so that the person can breathe a little bit better.
Because I see a blue inhaler and there's an orange one.
Yes, there's an orange one as well.
A short orange one as well. Okay.
Right, but the blue inhaler is the one that you use for to help to treat the chest tightness. The orange one is the steroid that you use to prevent the symptoms from coming on in the first place.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
All right.
You have a good evening as well.
Thank you kindly, sir. I've got a comment here now for the good doctor. Let me see if I can find it, please. Yeah, here it is. It says, good afternoon, Gregston, Dr. Lewis, and Dr. St. Hilaire. As usual, listening and always enjoying the program, I'm the second listener who's going to acknowledge Dr. St. Hilaire. And in quotations, it says, from strength to strength. I'm assuming that's a school motto.
Yes, it is.
All right. And condolences to the family of one of the former teachers, Mr. Cadogan, who's burying on Friday. They go on to say, I just want to bring up the incidence of people suffering from the yearly Saharan dust. There are some persons who don't suffer with sinus problems or allergies, but they have become affected. I don't know if this last part is for you, but it says also, is the Saharan dust in the atmosphere at this time of the year, since I haven't heard anything from the Met Office? I don't think that's for you. But what about the Saharan dust and how it affects people without allergies? What's the position with that?
The Saharan dust can certainly cause what we call respiratory symptoms. And, you know, in Barbados, we call everything sinuses. Once you get any issues, you see you got sinuses. Everybody has sinuses, by the way.
Yep.
But you can certainly get those respiratory symptoms. And so you can find that you have what we call a post-nasal drip. You have fluid dripping into the back of the throat. You can have the cough that's associated. So the issue with the Saharan dust is it's not like a viral infection. So it's not an organism causing it. But it's really your body's response to this foreign thing that is getting into the airways and causing a lot of inflammation. And so for the Saharan dust, it is really to help to treat the symptoms, because I don't believe you can extract the Saharan dust out of the atmosphere. Just to say that persons who already have chronic sinusitis or have other respiratory issues might be more affected by the Saharan dust, and those persons might need to be on their medications, so the medications that will help them to fight against their allergic symptoms. Those persons might need to be on their medications around the time of the year when you have a lot of Saharan dust acting up. We have a lot of interest in this area of respiratory illnesses, even outside of the infections. Dr. Gaten St. Hilaire, we're going to definitely have to do a part two and part three, where we talk a lot more a lot more about the respiratory tract, the chronic bronchitis and the asthma.
And we're not done with her yet, because I see a light blinking here. Let me go over to this and see if the person is still there. Good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Good evening, Gregston, and to you two lovely doctors.
There. Yes, they are indeed. So you can have your way with them verbally. Go ahead, please.
That's not a little bit funny. Docs, I want to ask the two girly doctors this question. What is asbestosis? And this question I'm asking for people working to the west of Bridgetown, and indeed for Gregston, who has been at ERA sometimes. What is our asbestosis, and what is the symptoms, and what can be the end result?
All right, so I'm not going to delve in too much. I will give you a basic answer. I promise you we're going to have some kind of session with a pulmonologist, and we're going to go through these kind of things. But asbestosis basically is when you have a chronic lung disease, and it's caused by inhaling those asbestos fibers. It can be a very serious condition. Like we said, it's a chronic disease, and it can cause a number of symptoms outside of the breathing difficulties. It can cause some symptoms as well across the body.
Can it also cause cancer?
It can. So there's a link to mesothelioma, a particular type of cancer associated with asbestos in exposure. And that is why there is a push to remove asbestos from buildings and those kind of things. So it can be very, very severe condition to have, because it causes scarring of the lung tissue.
But what's the symptoms, Doc? And are there any cures or treatments or anything for it?
All right, I'll tell you that really quickly, because like I said, this show in particular is about infectious disease. But some of the symptoms that you can have would be shortness of breath. So the symptoms that you expect to see with any respiratory condition. So you have your shortness of breath. The person might have cough. The person might have wheezing. And as the condition progresses, the symptoms can worsen.
I think that satisfies my queries and Gregston.
Yes, sir.
Because you work in that area from time to time.
Well, I'm glad you're looking out for me.
Yes, for all the people in the port, as a matter of fact. Okay.
All right. Thank you,
Gregston.
And you take care.
All right, man.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much for your calls, Connors. We're really happy to hear you this evening.
But I'm not letting you go just as yet. We've got another WhatsApper here. They're saying, good evening. Can you tell us how we can determine the difference between the symptoms of the flu and UTRI, since they are so similar?
UTRI.
Upper respiratory tract infection.
Right, correct.
Okay. So what I'm going to do, Grayson, because we don't have much time, but we're about to delve into the flu.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say that upper respiratory tract infections are just infections of the upper respiratory tract. So it affects, Dr. Gittins, you're the guest. Let me let you explain, and then we'll go ahead and talk about the flu.
Yeah, so basically, when we're talking about the flu primarily affects the upper respiratory tract. So it affects the nose, what we call the nares, the nasopharynx. It affects all of those areas. So those are some of the areas. Anything above the epiglottis, or where you swallow, would be the upper respiratory tract. Any area in that, your throat, all of those could be involved in the upper respiratory tract. So once you have any infection in that area, that will be considered an upper respiratory tract. And the flu virus, now what we call the flu virus, affects all of those, can affect any of those areas as well, but usually starts with the nose. So then you start with things like the runny nose and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the very, very short, just the different types of influenza? Because we talk about the influenza virus that causes flu.
Right. So influenza virus, there are four different types, A, B, C, and D. D is not usually associated with infections in humans. So you wouldn't have, that wouldn't cause any infections in humans, usually associated with cattle and so forth. But A, B, and C are our concern. So A can cause more severe infections than B, and C tends to cause mild infections. So all three of them, A, B, and C, can cause infections in humans. A tends to be more severe than B, and C tends to be very mild, cause very mild infections. And these influenza viruses, they tend to be, they can be seasonal. So you can have a particular time where you might have one particular type of flu. The thing is that we need to mention is that these flu viruses are made up of two major components that helps us to determine the differences between them. And these, once you have changes in those two components, then you would know which one is actually causing the infection. And so you can kind of monitor that to know what the which one is actually causing the infection at this particular time. So the seasonal flu can change, or it can modify itself over a time period, over a year or so.
Which is why you need to get vaccinated for the flu every year, because some people don't quite understand why there are yearly vaccines for the flu. But because the flu is able to change so much, that's why we end up with needing different vaccines every year.
Yes. WHO actually investigates the changes in those two components of the virus to see, you know, how they've changed over the year, and then they would develop a vaccine based on that. So then they would have, like, you can have a trivalent, you have can either have three separate viruses, or we can have a quadrivalent vaccine, which is four. So you can either have two A's, two influenza A viruses and a B, or two A's and two B's.
Excellent.
But they generally monitor this over the year to make sure that when they're developing the new vaccine, that it covers what is circulating at that time. So that when you get, so that's because the viruses change so frequently. It's like if you were, you know, you were typing out a document, for example, and you made some errors, and you obviously don't want to submit this, so you get somebody to come behind you and, you know, edit document, and it's fine. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine this was a virus, and this is influenza. Influenza doesn't have that person to come behind to make the corrections. So basically, that results in changes of those two major components, and that's why you need to monitor them, because the virus really can't check behind itself.
Right, changes naturally.
Yes.
So one of the things I'm interested in, we know that the symptoms can be very similar for all of these respiratory viruses, but there's something quite unique about the flu in terms of the onset of the symptoms when you compare it to something like RSV or even COVID. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, the incubation period is very short.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely short. Where with RSV, the incubation periods will be between 3 to 5 days. The incubation period for influenza can go from 1 day to 4 days. It is very, very short, and persons usually start with a very high fever. So you can start with a very high, and it's very abrupt in onset. So you get this abrupt start of fever, of flu-like symptoms. And as I said, it can start from, the incubation period can go from 1 day to 4 days. Right. So you can start with a very high fever. You can get sore throat, headache, your nose starts to run, and you get red watery eyes, you start to cough and so forth. So all of those are symptoms, but the primary thing is that very abrupt onset of very high fever, and it can start at least 1 day after being in contact with an individual who also has the flu.
Yeah, and that's so different, because oftentimes people come and say, you know, I had a sniffy nose this day, and then the next day I had a cough, and then the next day a sore throat. But with the flu, it's that you get hit by a truck one time. You know, one time hit by the truck, and you know, you're down for the count for the whole bit. So I talked about the symptoms, but I wondered who are the persons then who are most affected by the flu, and what can those complications look like?
Okay, so all age groups are affected by the flu. All of them can be affected, but some might be more at risk than others. And persons who tend to be at risk for more severe disease or who might end up with some form of complication might be those who are pregnant, children under the age of 3 years, those who are old. So you come back and you will hear me say again, you know, infection tends to be worse in those who are young and those who are very old. And then also those with any chronic underlying illnesses, you know, any diabetes, hypertension, any kidney problems, and so forth. Persons who are whose immune system isn't very healthy. So persons with such as HIV and AIDS, or persons who receive steroids and so forth, or persons who have cancers. So those tend to be, those persons tend to have a more severe illness, and the severe illness could come in the form of pneumonia. It could come in the form of sepsis, where the body basically is totally deranged when it gets the infection. So your immune system basically goes out of whack. And you can also, persons can also die from influenza as well.
Yeah, influenza is definitely a major cause of death in the U.S. If they have a very bad outbreak in those, that we said, temperate countries, they can have quite a few deaths associated with influenza. And like you said, that's why they really do push for vaccination to protect their population. So there's a question that I have, and I think a lot of the listeners have it. We know that during the height of the pandemic, there were less recorded cases of influenza. And people are assuming that, you know, they're calling everything COVID, and that's why there's this big conspiracy. But can you tell us why it is that during the height of the COVID pandemic, it seemed like there were fewer cases of influenza, but where we might be seeing more of a spike now again?
Okay, so when we had, in the height of COVID, everyone was kind of locked away. So we were either quarantining ourselves away if you thought you had symptoms. You were isolated if you had the infection, and generally you were basically kept in lockdown. So you were just confined to your immediate family members most of the time. Or if you had to venture out, you had to wear masks. Some persons wore a face shield. You had to wash your hands and so forth. There was hand sanitizing at, you know, almost at every doorway, and there was also social distancing. If you remember when I was talking about respiratory syncytial virus, and even when we're talking about COVID, the way in which it's transmitted is through those respiratory droplets, again, those droplets that have the virus in it. So if you were wearing masks and face shields, and you're washing your hands and so forth, washing your hands to eradicate the virus from off of it, you were sanitizing surfaces every minute, we were wiping down stuff, and, you know, we were spraying everything. So we would have eradicated COVID, and we also would have eradicated a lot of the other viruses that were there, because all of these interventions, the masks, the face shields, and the wiping down of surfaces, the social distancing or physical distancing, as properly called, this would have prevented basically those droplets from getting into those areas, your eyes and your mouth and so forth. So it didn't only do that for COVID, it did that for all the other viruses, and that's why it was able to reduce the incidence, or what we call those non-pharmaceutical interventions, were able to reduce the incidence of the other types of respiratory virus. It was able to decrease the incidence of the flu, of respiratory syncytial virus, of the common cold, usually caused by rhinoviruses. So it was able to reduce the incidence of all of those. Now that we've been freed, liberated a bit, no mask wearing and stuff
we
like
outside.
That. We outside, and you know what happened? We wearing no masks, no shields, no hand sanitizer wherever you go. So guess what's going to happen then? viruses are at liberty. When we talk, we laugh, we sneeze, we cough, all of those organisms are present in the environment. We pass by and we waste it in and we get infected. So that's why now we're seeing a lot more of these infections.
All right, that makes perfect sense to me. I want to, we're wrapping up the program now, and I'm going to let you have your closing comments, but I really think this is important to point out. Many times when persons come and sit in the chair and they have this runny nose and this cough and so forth, you know, as a doctor, you look at them and based on the history, what they have told you and what you've examined, this is looking like we didn't get to go into bacterial infections this evening, but we're going to have a part two of Dr. Gittins. But basically, you can tell that this infection is likely viral and not bacterial, but patients come with the expectation of getting antibiotics, and they feel like you are not a good doctor unless you write a prescription for antibiotics. Can you share with us why antibiotics are not appropriate for a viral respiratory tract infection, whether it be the flu, whether it be COVID, whether it be RSV, why they're not appropriate, and why, in fact, they can actually cause the patient harm in the long term?
Okay. So, as just mentioned, the respiratory tract, the upper respiratory tract infections in particular, are caused by viruses, which are completely different than bacteria. Most of these infections can be what we term self-limiting. You usually get better all by yourself. So there's no real need to treat, or you just treat the symptoms, right? So you are talking about two different things. We're talking about a virus on one hand, and then we're talking about bacteria, two different organisms. You cannot treat a virus with an antibacterial agent. The whole structure, the makeup of a virus is completely different than that of a bacteria. So when I give somebody an antibacterial agent for a virus, what I am doing is that I'm wiping out the bacteria within them. So everybody has bacteria in your body. I'm either wiping out that bacteria, or I'm causing that bacteria to now change and modify so that, you know, it can develop resistance. It can see the drug and it says, well, what's this here? I see already. And it continues to replicate. So what happens is that the drug, the antibiotic that is present, that is there, that is supposed to be treating a bacterial infection that isn't there, it causes those bacteria that are present there to actually mutate and develop genes and so forth that would confer resistance to that particular antibiotic. So you don't want to give antiviral agents to any bacteria, any infection you consider bacterial, because you can develop resistance. So at the time now where you actually need the antibiotic, it isn't working because the bacteria would have already seen that drug already, developed resistance to it, and it's not going to work. And so that's a problem that is quite evident nowadays. A lot of persons are either, number one, they are taking antibiotics for viral infections, which they should not be, or they would given antibiotics for bacterial infections, and when they feel a little better, they decided to stop taking the antibiotics, and it really hasn't cured the infection.
And so you get a lot, like you said, a lot of resistance, and that's why we don't want people saying, well, I don't feel good, I'm not going to the doctor. Even if you don't come to the doctor, please don't go to the pharmacist and ask for antibiotics.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, there are some pharmacies that might slip them over to you. But you are really doing yourself harm. You're really doing yourself a disservice. When you have a viral infection, like Dr. Gittins St. Louis said, your immune system is what really fights off that infection. And the bacteria, the good bacteria in your body now that actually helps, because there's good bacteria in your body now, you're exposing to antibiotics. You don't want to kill that that good bacteria, and you don't want to expose any trace, any bacteria in there to that and cause resistance, like you said. So just an appeal, please, don't play your own doctor. Even if you stay home and you take your vitamin C and drink your water and you do the things you're supposed to do, take your multi-symptom paracetamol or whatever, just don't go and get antibiotics really, really. You want to really, really point that out. It's causing a big problem. I want to thank you, Dr. Gittin St. Helier, for being with us. We are right at the top of the hour, so I want to give you the opportunity to give your closing comments. Before you do so, I want to let our listeners know that we are looking to have a program very soon. We're not just going to talk about the viruses and the bacteria that can cause infections, but we want to give you some information on how you can build up your immune system so as to prevent these infections, or if you get them, to make sure that the symptoms are very mild. So I want you guys to stay locked on. Listen out for that program so you can know how to get yourself in a good and healthy shape. So Dr. Gittin St. Helier, we didn't get to talk a lot about prevention. So I'm going to, you know, give you the last minute or two. Can you just tell us quickly, in your closing comments, how can we prevent the transmission of these viruses, stop ourselves from getting sick or, you know?
So one of the primary ways to prevent any infection is for vaccination, to vaccinate yourself or to get vaccinated. One of the primary vaccines we have out there is for the flu. So we can take our annual flu vaccines. That's available. But one of the other things that we can also do is to make sure that you wash your hands. So washing your hands is critical, absolutely important. One of the other things you need to do is to make sure that if you are coughing or sneezing or so forth, you can either wear a mask, or if you are not wearing a mask, you cough into your elbow, you sneeze into your elbow. You make sure that when you're using any tissues or anything, you dispose of it properly. You also would want to separate yourself from persons who may not be infected. So you want to separate yourselves from those persons so that you would not infect those individuals. You also want to make sure that you're properly hydrated and so forth, and then that you treat your symptoms appropriately. As also, if you feel any worse, you should always go to your physician. But the primary things in terms of prevention of those infections, to make sure you have proper hand washing, you have good hygiene, you self-isolate, you avoid contact with persons who are sick, and you avoid touching your eyes, your nose, and your mouth.
All right, with that, I want to say,
Yeah, go ahead. Give your final word. Go ahead. Sorry for interrupting.
That's all right. With that, we want to say thank you so much, Dr. Gittin St. Helier. This has been a very informative program. You've given us a lot of information. You fielded the questions very well. So thank you so much for your time and your expertise. As always, thank you, Gregson, for your technical support. Big thank you to all the callers that have shared and contributed to make this program so interesting this evening. And we want to thank Starcom Network 92.9. We want to thank you for continuing to partner with the Barbados Association of Medical Practitioners to bring this program to you, the public. Good evening, and wishing you a wonderful, healthy week.
All right. Thank you so kindly. That's Dr. Keel Lewis, your presenter this evening of the Better Health Radio Show. And as her guest, we had Dr. Marquita Gittins St. Helier. Her first appearance, I believe, notwithstanding, it won't be her last, because we've already invited her back. At least Dr. Lewis has already invited her back. So,
She has a fan club. She already has a fan club.
I realize that.
Have her back.
So thank you kindly to both Dr. St. Helier and
Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome, ma'am. Have a good evening until we meet again. Take care.
Thank you.
You're welcome.